Oh, hello there. Welcome to Pop and Lock. I'm Landry Ayers.
And I'm Natalie Dalzicki.
It's officially holiday season, and what better way to celebrate than by kicking up our feet, grabbing some hot cocoa, and diving into our favorite feel-good holiday classics. We'll be discussing heartwarming topics such as, does the subsidization of Santa's workshop actually hurt competition? Why is it so hard for Hermie the Elf to become a licensed dentist? And why are we diverting NORAD resources to track a sleigh that flies 3,000 times faster than the speed of sound?
To answer these questions and more, we're joined by Libertarianism.org's Paul Matsko.
Thanks for having me, guys.
And Paul Meany.
Thanks for having me.
We'll kick things off with a classic, Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life. So the Pauls, you tell me, is it actually a wonderful life?
Well, it's actually always wonderful if you're Mr. Potter. I mean, he seems like a perfectly happy individual come Christmas time.
So why don't we take a step back? Who is Mr. Potter in our film?
Maybe we should do a quick rundown. Okay, so Mr. Potter is the big bad guy in the show, right? He's the banker. This is in 1947, it's released. So the Great Depression is still in memory. And the big banks didn't, come out of the Great Depression looking all that great with their users. So they're the bad guys. Mr. Potter's the bad guy. He wants to own everything in town. And he wants to squeeze out the little man, the working man. They shouldn't get credit. They shouldn't be allowed to own houses. They should rent from him in his slums. And the good guy, George Bailey, he and his uncle, formerly his father, his uncle wasn't formerly his father. He used to do what his father does, yes. Yeah. But the Baileys owned the Bailey Brothers Savings and Loan, and they look out for the little guy. They lend to Bert and Ernie, the cop and the taxi cab driver. Not the Muppets. They might lend. Hey, there's a tie over to our Muppets Christmas Carol. But they look out for the little guy. They lend to workers so they can own their own homes and be part of the American dream. Potter isn't like this. So the big – in the background of the story, it's this struggle between Potter and Bailey for the kind of control of the financial soul of the town. That's the first three quarters of the film. And in the last quarter, George Bailey gets beaten down by Potter's attacks, by small town life, by the – crushing of his hopes and dreams, which we'll talk about more later. And the final fourth is and spoiler alert for those of our listeners who haven't seen It's a Wonderful Life, he contemplates committing suicide, but an angel intervenes and shows him life if he had never been born. And he realizes how full his life actually is and how much good he's done for the town. And everyone sings Auld Lang Syne at the end, and it's a happy ending.
Also, I'm just going to put in a side note. If you haven't seen It's a Wonderful Life by this point, you should probably turn the show off and watch it. It's been out for a while. Just kind of piggybacking off what Paul said. So George Bailey is the main character. We get his entire life story. He wants to go and travel. He is essentially the embodiment of the American dream. He has lots of dreams. He doesn't want to stay stuck in this small town. One of the first scenes in the beginning is he gets this giant suitcase and he is talking about all the stickers he wants to put on it. And then his father passes away and he learns that he's going to have to take over the family business. And instead, he allows everyone else to go after their dreams. So his brother doesn't have to stay home to take care of the business. His brother actually ends up going off to war. But it's kind of a story about either... mixed reviews. It's either a story about someone being selfless and allowing everyone else to travel to go after their dreams, to travel, etc., or it's a story about just giving up on your dreams. So I was shocked when I was reading some. I've seen this movie plenty of times, but I was just curious. I was reading some critics that from a variety of time periods. So I read a critique from 1980. I read one from 2003, and all of them were very pessimistic about the video, about the movie. They didn't necessarily think it was all that positive because we watch it as a feel good movie. But if you really get down to the nitty gritty or how they treat women and that kind of stuff, it's not actually all that feel good. Though it ends up okay for George. So
The whole movie is just his life being like not ruined by any chance. But he starts the movie off, loses his hearing, doesn't get to go to college, misses his honeymoon. Like every time something good is going for him in his life, something goes wrong and he takes responsibility and helps people out. So,
well, the problem is we are Sam Wainwrights, all of us here in this room. So his perspective and the moral of the story, which is for supposed to be for people like him, falls flat on us to some extent. So, but what I mean by that is Sam Wainwright in the film is a bit character. He's a like a friend of George's who he does all the things George wishes he would have done. He goes off, kind of sees the world. He's a big city guy. He gets rich in plastics. It just a couple of times cracks me up at the time. They're like, I told George you could have gotten in on the ground floor of plastics. but in a sense, today he would be like a tech person, a tech entrepreneur, or somebody who goes to the big city where he gets a law degree and is a high powered attorney or a right. So Sam Wainwright is the cosmopolitan that gets out of the small town, has a high flying, well off, seemingly very happy life. George Bailey is the one who stays in his small town. I kind of imagine this is like small town Ohio. I have no reason to believe that Bedford Falls is in Ohio, but that's like my mental image. But he stays at home. He's the good son. Doesn't go off and get an advanced education. He doesn't, you know, get to travel the world and become a National Geographic explorer like he imagines as a kid. He doesn't make $1 million by the time he's 30. So all of that, like, those of us here in this room made the opposite choice. We left Texas or South Carolina or Ireland or right, like, and moved to the city. We are Sam Wainwright. So it kind of makes sense that it feels a little bit off, that something about his life choices wouldn't resonate with us. So I don't know. Do you feel like a Sam Wainwright?
At times, I certainly do. When you brought up the question of like he represents this American dream, to me it raises the question like at what point does he represent the American dream, and what does that – when you identify as like, oh, that's what it is, what does that say about what you think the American dream is? Is it – you know, sacrificing yourself for others and building a community. And in that case, I think he sort of ends up with the American dream and through all that struggle. Or is it that he, you know, tries to pull himself up by his bootstraps and be self-sufficient throughout a struggle, which is very much like this myth of the self-made man, and myth not in the fake sense, but in the sort of like larger like story we tell ourselves as our nation? Or is it the idea that he's like someone who wants to go out and see the world and be this sort of like he's not a cowboy straight going out west, but he has that kind of rugged individualism, and I think where you identify what you see as the American dream really comes through in sort of what you pick up as where was the point in his story that you see him, you know, lose what his goal was. So I thought that was really interesting for you to bring up there.
Yeah, I was going to even have a follow-up question about what do we individually think that this movie is saying about the American dream? Because to me, like when I think American dream, I think immigrant. I think that they're coming over with nothing. They're, like Landry just said, pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. That kind of sentiment. But that's not what I see in George Bailey. Like they have a small family business or a closely family run business. He's not necessarily left with nothing. And in the event that he is, it's due to an error from someone in someone's family, his uncle. I'm blanking on his uncle's first name, but Uncle Billy like accidentally gives the money to Mr. Potter in his newspaper.
We all have an Uncle Billy, don't we?
So then I guess like in theory, George Bailey then has nothing and then has to like overcome that error. But like then again, that's not really like a rags to riches type story. I think that's just like, oh, that's like an unfortunate event that happened in his life. And I really don't think this is a story about an American dream. I just think it's kind of showing where America is stuck in like our post-war world. So it's kind of between like Pottersville to me kind of represents future in the movie, and Bedford Falls is what George Bailey is so like desperately holding on to, like what it represents and like the nostalgia of Bedford Falls and keeping it local. But what do you guys think?
In my opinion, I think that I don't exactly know if it would be about the American dream, but I think there's a line early on in the film that hints towards what it's kind of trying to portray. And it's before George is about to leave for college. His brother's graduating school, and he's talking to his dad, and his dad kind of whispers to himself that it's deep in the race of men to want to own their own house, basically. I think a lot of the film is about a dignified living. And it's not about Potter. Like, Potter's life, has more than he can ever spend, is what a lot of people say about him. But he is, like, you know, he has no family, he has no friends, he only has sycophants who will, like, worship him for money. And so when George is, like, in a bad place and thinking about suicide, the whole point of it is to show that it's not monetary success, or it's not what you own that makes your life much better. It's how you serve people in your community and how you help people out. And he thought he'd never help anyone, but literally everyone had a house because of him and what he did. And so I think that's what the movie's kind of about, is that he helped other people have a dignified life and a dignified life himself. And it's not a bad thing to not be a massive financial success at all turns. You don't have to live this adventurous, crazy, amazing life. You can have a good, quiet, happy life.
So ultimately, he fulfills his father's kind of vision for the good life. In the end, I like that as like a thesis statement for like, what's the moral of this film? We're going to have my dad say it right before he croaks with a stroke.
Yeah. And it's also like the idea of Potter is that it's not just like renting property is a bad thing. It's that he wants to keep people at his will, and he'll always have some sort of power over them, and that's the problem. But everyone else has some sort of level of independence because of George, and because George isn't cruel like that.
It definitely fits in. Here's where it does tie, I think, into a vision of the American dream. But it's bigger than that. It's not just, I mean, because these questions of what is the good life are very old. But that sense of people should be smallholders, or in the old world sense, freeholders. They should own their own fee simple property, farm their own little plot, have their own space on God's green earth that is theirs inviolably. This rejection of the idea of a rentier class, the people who rent out land. So, of course, in an Irish context, that's very old, dealing with these English landlords, these potters, class English surname, renting out land to the poor Irish and keeping them in, you know, serfdom, essentially. So it's kind of a rejection. It is that vision of, like, in American context, that is very Jeffersonian, yeoman farmers. It's even, we had this discussion on Free Thoughts about Josh Hawley's vision of Epicurean liberalism, which is a rejection of the Sam Wainwright cosmopolitan vision of the good life, and the affirmation of the small freeholders owning their own plot in small town virtues across America vision. So, like, that is a very American, you know, historical theme, but a broader, deeper philosophical concept. So in that sense, we do see that here. The other bit, though, I think where we do have some of that American dream being affirmed here is the immigration angle. So Frank Capra is a first-generation Italian immigrant. He comes over. He is dirt poor, scrabbles his way up through the Italian ghetto of Los Angeles. And to be Italian in America in the 1910s and 20s, like he was to be the contemporary corollary would be to be Mexican in America today, facing lots of prejudice, lots of nativism, lots of, just oppression because of your ethnicity. And so people didn't like Italian. Like, this is the time of the second Ku Klux Klan when he's coming of age, who don't want these Southern Europeans and Eastern Europeans coming over and immigrating, because they can't be fully American. They can't be fully integrated. And you know what? They're not even really white. In fact, if you look at political cartoons from the time, especially people from Southern Italy, like Capra, Sicilians, or Naples, were considered not white, like Northern Italians. Northern Italians, okay, they're okay. But Southern Italians, oh no. I mean, because they intermarried with the Moors and when the Muslims. It's a whole complicated.
There was a character as well who was Italian, Martini, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he eventually gets his own home as well. He used to live in one of Potter's shacks, and then he moves out eventually and has his own home, and there's a big speech about they have the different things they give them as gifts.
Yep. So and Martini plays an important role in here. And I think what Capper's doing is he is saying, and this kind of undergirds the entire story. He's saying, how do we know that you can integrate white ethnics, Italians, like Martini, who plays this really big role, which is odd because if you think about Bedford Falls, I don't know, let's say Ohio or Massachusetts, the Martini figure is kind of odd. Like, usually Italian immigrants come to New York City, to big cities first. So why does he insert an Italian character there? Well, he's saying, how do we know that Italians, like myself, Frank Capra, the director of the movie, and Martini, the character in the film, how do we know they can integrate and become fully American? We know that because the Baileys did. Bailey is an Irish name, right?
Throw some Irish Bailey's cream in your hot chocolate.
Yeah, I know. It's like you don't get more Irish than Bailey's Irish cream.
Is that accurate, Meany? You don't get more Irish than throwing Bailey's in your...
Even though I'm Irish, I've barely drank any Bailey's ever.
Oh, man. Do they drink it in Ireland?
Some people do. It's kind of a Christmas thing, actually.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Do you have eggnog?
No.
Oh, interesting. Anyway, back to Paul.
Yeah. No. So you have the Baileys here, right? They represent – and the big wave of Irish immigration comes over in the 1830s and 40s. So by the 1940s especially, but by the time of Capra has come, same pattern there. They weren't considered integratable. They're Catholic. They speak Gaelic. They don't – you know, like – they're not considered fully white in 19th century political cartoons. But they had integrated. They had become American. They've been Americanized and they were considered fully white and yada, yada. And there's all these markers of that in here. I mean, like the Baileys are sending their boys to college. Harry's a member of an eating club, which is – so before there were fraternities at colleges, there were dining clubs or eating clubs. And they still exist at like Ivy League colleges. But Harry's a member of one. He's going to be a member of a dining club. There's reference there. How do you know they're fully white? Well, they have black servant, right? And of course, part of being white in America means showing that your social status is above African Americans. So Capra makes these decisions to show that the Baileys had become respectable pillars of the community, and now they could give an arm up to the next wave of immigrants, your Martinis and the like.
One weird thing about the story, though, is that normally you talk about American Dream, it's rags to riches. But in this story, it's actually like riches to rags. Mm-hmm. His dad's house seems much better than his. And then he eventually moves into a worse house and he has way less money. At one point, I was looking up how much money he earned a week. I tried to translate it in inflation because it was $145 a week, I think, something like that. And then Potter's talking about him like, oh, and you have a kid, you only have $10 a week to save. And you have another kid, you'll have nothing left. So he wasn't even earning very much. And he comes home and complains about his house the entire time when he has that bad day.
Definitely doesn't make like the DIY movement look very good. Like the horrors of trying to fix up that big old drafty mansion.
Yeah. What's the thing on the stairs he keeps trying to?
Oh, it's like part of the rail, right?
The banister.
Like, yeah, it's part of the banister that always falls off. Yeah. Well, I also thought so. Like going back to what we were saying about home ownership too, I think it's interesting that throughout the film, like a lot that we see is about either owning a house or fixing up a house or creating a neighborhood or slums. That is a common theme throughout the movie. And I think it starts with the raggedy house and that's where they got engaged, right?
That's where they first went.
Where they fell in love.
The house and broke it.
Something like that. And then he bought the house. Big romantic gesture. But here we are.
A bit presumptuous.
Yeah. But... so here we are with this old rackety house, and he always makes comments coming back to it too. And then when he goes and to work and the savings and loan, he's one of those people that trusts that he's going to give out a loan that maybe someone can't afford now for their house or for their home, but will afford at some point. So he's very trusting in a sense that's almost not great.
Well, he knows people personally. There's a point where I think it's Potter is talking about the taxi driver. I forget his name now, but he's saying, how will he ever pay this loan back? And he's like, well, he just had a bad day or a bad week and he'll pay it back eventually. And he always does. And like, I can vouch for his character. So he knows everyone in the town, so he can act like that. But Potter doesn't. Like, Potter has no friends, no family, so he can't trust people the same way George does.
Yeah, it is this kind of rejection of it's not a full-blown rejection of capitalism per se.
It's faceless capitalism they don't like.
Yeah, it's kind of it's a particular vision of again, it goes back to that smallholder, small town where you know everyone, you vouch for their character, and a rejection of big capitalist institutions that are faceless and nameless. Of course, there's a plus and a minus to this. Like I can't imagine if I were on the board of directors of a bank and the person who has fiduciary responsibility for making sure that the bank stays solvent is like, yeah, I gave a loan to him because he's a friend and I'll vouch for him. And, and like has his literal uncle. I mean, it's like reverse nepotism because Nepos is nephew. Reverse nepotism. You have your uncle who's clearly incompetent. Uncle Billy should be nowhere. He should be barred from being within 100 feet.
And he has the bird in the bank as well.
He has the bird
in
the
bank. And he has a squirrel in his house.
He is like,
very eccentric.
The bird in the bank is worth two in the book. So.
That's right. But this is – it's like a vision of I'm not so convinced. Like, so obviously Potter's framed as the bad guy, but you think about what depersonalized institutions actually can do. So this vision of like the small town life where you know everyone and everyone gets along and pulls together at the savings and loan, that sounds all well and good. But imagine if you grew up in Bedford Falls and you weren't white. Yep. Or you weren't the right kind of immigrant who wanted to integrate.
Woman.
Or you were a woman trying to start her own business. Or you were black or you were gay or like small town life, that kind of dense network of I'll give you options. I'll lend to you. I'll let you go to college. If you fit in, that sounds great as long as you're someone who can fit in.
It's very easy to forget. It's, when you watch it, yeah. It's so glamour and glitzy. You're like, oh, it's so great. The 40s sound great. And then you realize, except for everyone else.
But Potter, ironically, if he was not framed as like always being this cackling bad guy, that vision means we don't care if you're gay or you're black or you're white or you're Christian or Catholic or whatever. We'll lend to you if you're reliable. You know, like that actually can be freeing for the very people who would find Bedford Falls stultifying otherwise.
Well, I also thought it was interesting because throughout the film, we see very little minority characters. So we see, well, there are females in the story, but they don't really have a lot other than being like homemakers or in the alternate and George's alternate universe. She's a librarian who apparently makes nothing of her life when she doesn't have George Bailey.
A movie from the 40s with shallow female characters?
Who's the girl who fancies George at the beginning? The blonde girl.
The blonde girl with the curly hair, right?
Violet.
Violet.
She goes off to work in New York. That's as close as we get to female empowerment.
Yeah, but his wife essentially like, the movie literally says his wife could not have a life without him because she comes like some like raggedy librarian and just is like waiting around for her Prince Charming, which like is BS. But besides the point, the other thing I was just thinking, I forgot about the part when there's a run on the bank, which like none of us thankfully have experience, but there was a run on the bank and he had like $3 left or whenever he was giving out. Yeah. He had $2
left. Procreate eventually.
Yeah. Which was his honeymoon fund. He has $2 left that he's giving out to people. And the last person he gave it to was an old female. I'm blanking on her name right now, but I also thought that was interesting that they did throw some female characters in there, probably just as fillers because I mean, most of the women portrayed in this movie are very ditzy and can't have a life without their husband. And
well, there is I think the representation of women, I mean, that it really is so striking, that final scene, like, and also the horror. Anyone who's worked for a library would be like, the horror, the worst thing you can imagine, life without a man means being a librarian. But the role of race in the film, while it's kind of minor, it is there. Like you have, I counted three kind of black characters in the film.
The absence of it says a lot about it.
But you have Annie, who's the hired help, who they casually sexually harass, swats her on the rear end. You have a black couple on the town laughing at George Bailey when he was kind of this romantic vision to Violet. So part of the nightlife scene, which is disapproved of in the film. And then tellingly, you have a black piano player in the alternate version of the
Potter's
Next Bar. So, like, this is part of that whole immigrant framing, but there's the good immigrant and the bad immigrant.
Yep.
That's going on. The good immigrant, you know, runs a bar, but makes sure people don't drink too much. He's very responsible, playing traditional Italian music in the background. The bad version of the immigrant bar, Nick's Bar, has a black piano player playing jazz. And that's one of the things that in the 1940s, you know, white folk would have heard jazz playing and been like, oh, black people, jazz, bad.
Do you remember
parts
how Nick describes the bar?
No, how does he describe it?
He starts talking and Clarence starts talking. The guardian angel of George starts talking to him and eventually he just says, this is a bar for hard liquor to get people drunk fast and nothing else.
Yeah.
Well, it's also very telling of the time too, how they treat alcohol in this film. So like they're it's insinuated that no one should be drinking and that they're like very anti-alcohol, which like this isn't too far away from prohibition, but it's very frowned upon. Like just like the quote you were just saying, it's very frowned upon. And like because George is like stumbling drunk in his alternate universe and comes up across the pharmacist that he ended up saving his job, but since he was never born, the pharmacist was like a drunk and had gone to jail for 10 years because he ended up killing
His son. Yeah.
Killing his son with the medicine that George had found, the incorrect medicine. But I think it's very interesting just because when we watch it, we're like, we might not pick up on those subtleties because alcohol is like a normal part of our lives. But back then it was like everyone agreed that alcohol was more of like promiscuous, so to speak. Or
whenever you drink, it's only hard liquor.
Yeah.
No one ever drinks like a beer or something. It's always like a double bourbon is what he orders in the bar.
Yeah.
It's true.
I think the most important question that we could ask ourselves, though, about It's a Wonderful Life is it even a Christmas movie? And I don't think so. In this essay, I will. So the movie is 2 hours and 15 minutes long. If you watch it on TV, it'll take you half the day with commercials around that time of year. And only the last 57 minutes are actually devoted to occurring during, I believe it's Christmas Eve, and a very short portion at the beginning when we see a lot of these through flashbacks once the angel has visited George Bailey. But I think it begs the question, how do we define a Christmas movie? Does it need to be set during Christmas? Because if so, as a lot of people have compared online, Die Hard, also a Christmas movie. But I would argue, and a lot of other people have said so as well, Christmas is more of a theme hit upon in Die Hard than in It's a Wonderful Life. Now, I don't think that it's a bad movie, and I don't think that there are not values that could align during Christmas time. But you could theoretically take this movie and put it during Thanksgiving, and the gathering of the family at the end could be, you know, a group, a Thanksgiving dinner that everyone gathers to put together. And 99% of the themes could make sense and still have a lot of thematic impact. So I, you know, just to play contrarian a little bit, I don't consider it a Christmas film.
Okay, well, I'm not going to lay out my thesis here, but if we're not delineating it as a holiday film or a Christmas movie, mind you, we did say these were feel-good classics, which
fair.
Which
fair.
Most
I can't
most,
argue with that.
Most holiday movies, if they're not comedy, they're still like some type of feel-good, happy at the end, and everyone gets gifts or everyone drinking hot chocolate
Krampus
or Bailey's.
Krampus is great. But...
Okay, Krampus is a different category, but I don't think you can delineate it in any other way than saying it's a holiday movie. Would you watch It's a Wonderful Life in the middle of July?
I mean, whether I would watch it is something completely different. But I'm just – and Paul, you look like you were about to say something.
Well,
come in, save me here.
Just going to make a quick note, which was that this movie was originally not intended to be released at Christmas time. They ended up
– That doesn't help his thesis.
Yeah, it doesn't help. It actually kind of helps Natalie, I suppose. But maybe – no, maybe, I don't know who helps. Because
I don't know about
that. They were going to release a different picture at Christmas time. This was going to come out like – midsummer, then they had to delay it. They decided to try to release it at Christmas, but they released it late. In most locations, it came out in January of 1948. So,
but wasn't it like a flop?
It did
it
okay.
Yeah.
The problem was it was a very expensive film to make, so it underperformed like expectations. But it was like the sixth highest grossing film of the year.
But it's typically on, you know, ABC, TBS, well, all of our Christmas, 12 Days of Christmas countdown,
here's
right?
What I'll say. It has become a Christmas film due to cultural events surrounding the movie. The fact that the copyright on the actual film, not the story, but the film lapsed. And so a lot of people were able to buy up their rights and I was going to say stream it, but to broadcast it very frequently, very cheaply during, I believe it was like the 1970s was when that started. So the film in a vacuum as a discrete piece of media
is what I say I would not call it a Christmas movie. I think that after all of the events and it becoming, you know, sort of a ritual, a tradition that people do, much in the same way, you know, A Christmas Story is played 24 hours on TBS every single year. I see why we consider it now to be a Christmas movie. But until learning about that, I was always confused as to once I saw the movie, because I had like seen scenes of it or like knew about it for many years. But when I actually sat down, I think it was like a late teen, and I actually watched the whole thing. I like knocked out a whole afternoon by watching it on TV during Christmas.
And
one
you seem
year.
Like you deeply regretted it.
No, I enjoyed the movie. Like it is a great movie. I'm not hating on Frank Capra's work. It is A Wonderful Life, after all.
And Jimmy Stewart is oh so good looking.
Oh yeah. Mr. Potter. Wait, okay. Jimmy Stewart, how did you come into the studio? That's amazing. The ghost of Jimmy Stewart, everyone.
Well, thank you for having me.
That's pretty good. I like that. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, you tell him.
So one of the things I was also – one of the reasons it makes me think of Christmas in particular – is the because of the angel Clarence. So a lot of holiday movies typically have angels or ghosts or some type of, I mean, if we want to get all Hallmarky, what's that?
The Spirit of Christmas.
The Spirit of Christmas.
Now that is a Christmas movie, and we'll get to that.
But so I think that with the existence of the angel, that makes it a stronger case to be a holiday film.
The angels are throughout the Bible, though. They weren't just, they didn't just herald the birth of Jesus.
But doesn't it have like a little bit of an essence, same like Christmas Carol obviously has all the ghosts that come in it, and we'll talk about that later. But I think that kind of ties in the holiday season a bit more. Though, as Paul said earlier, that was only like a quarter of the movie, right? That wasn't actually, angels weren't a bigger part of the movie. Though I'm not seceding to you right now.
Angels second class as well.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you tell us what you think. Make sure to send us a message or tweet at us and tell us, do you think It's a Wonderful Life is a Christmas or holiday movie? I'm very curious to know what the listeners think.
Well, regardless what we think or they think, it's still going to be on, you know, 24/7 every night leading up to Christmas this year.
So
you win there. Yes.
All right, so the next movie we wanted to cover was A Christmas Carol.
Excuse me, Natalie. I would just like to clarify. We are discussing The Muppets Christmas Carol.
Because there's only been 30 renditions of A Christmas Carol.
Yeah, but none of them have involved Henson-esque puppets. And everybody loves puppets.
Yeah, it makes the story 10 times better.
It's true. When you've got Gonzo and Rizzo the Rat narrating, acting as a Greek chorus for Dickens' classic, I think it really elevates it to another level.
Does everybody... So I have this theory that puppets... There's a chronological delay here.
It's true.
Muppets.
It is Muppets.
that the phenomenon of puppets, whether Muppets or not... They might look to future generations like clowns do to us. So clowns become super popular in the 1940s and 50s, early television. Like they're desperate to get some content on TV. So they're like, let's take clowns from the circus and have all these clown – like clowns will do variety shows for kids. But the problem – and that lasted – that went pretty well for young boomers who fondly remember like these clown shows they literally grew up with. But then people started – they were weirded out by clowns eventually. We got clown saturation and we're in a post-clown moment. Like clown, I know. But like clowns now are creepy. They're scary. There's like a little literal horror movie. I forget the name of it where a guy puts on like a clown nose and it transforms him into an evil like serial killing clown.
So not like, quite Krampus.
Not quite Krampus. Or it. It is a clown.
Oh, yeah. Right? It is a clown. Yeah.
Like you can't have a non-ironic clown as like – a good, wholesome, like, I it sounds bizarre, but imagine if like all the late night shows were hosted by clowns. That's how big of a deal they were in the 50s. But maybe puppets and Muppets fill that same kind of niche. They were very popular in the late 70s, 80s, 90s. They've tailed off a bit recently, though maybe a bit of a revival, but will in 30 years.
Yeah. With CGI and animation sort of filling a void, I think now that it's especially cheaper and cheaper to produce, and that's the kind of like children's content that we want because it's sort of, it can be fantastical and everything. I wonder if that will sort of move on and take the place that, that Muppets and Puppets did. I hope that we have a like a creepy Muppet scare, how clowns come back every few years, and they're right. Like, a clown was stalking children.
But it's kind of hard to be scary when they're 2 foot tall.
Well, that's like, hoping is it's like you're seeing like a Gonzo the Grouch Muppet leapt out and scared a couple while walking down the sidewalk in Cedar Rapids.
There'll be a horror movie 30 years from now where Jim Henson, the puppet, you know, like it goes around and stabs people.
The Puppet Master in theaters this Halloween.
Yeah, right.
I'm rolling my eyes at all of you.
So, getting back on topic, I think, Natalie, this is a good question. You seem tired of you mentioned 30 different renditions. Are you tired of Christmas Carol?
I'm not tired of it. I mean, it's a classic. I am going to admit that I've actually never read the story. Mid-1800s, right? Like 1850-something or 40-something?
1800s. It's right after the Poor Laws of 1834. That's
how of course. Yes.
I can give you the,
we
context.
All knew that.
You don't have the big context.
Context. Yeah.
So Thomas Robert Malthusus was a economist and thinker, wrote an essay on principle of population, and he talked about how the growth of the human race is what he calls geometric, might call exponential. So we grow in like 2, then 4, then 8, then 16, then 32. But he said food production, or like the growth of food surplus, I guess you might call it, that was arithmetic. So he'd say it grew by 10, then another 10. So go 10, 20, 30. And so he believed that no matter what, there'd always be too many people eventually. And so whenever we had a surplus of new food, thanks to new production methods, any standard living that we had, any increase in standard living would eventually be done in because exponential growth of the human race would stop it and we'd all go back to subsistence level. It's called the Iron Law of Wages. This sounds very bizarre. But anyway, going on, in 1601, there was the Poor Laws of Elizabethan England, and they talked a lot about how if someone is dying of starvation, well, the government should do something about it and help them survive. But in 1834, influenced by the theories of Robert Malthusus and the Iron Law of Wages and how there'd be too many people, the British government decided to get rid of that and have the workhouses instead. And so they said, you know, we'll make workhouses so it's really unattractive to ever go on relief, and so you'll have to work for it. And Charles Dickens, who wrote A Christmas Carol, was very poor growing up, and his father owed £40 for buying bread. And back then, you went into the debtor's prison. That's why Scrooge is the bad guy, because his family, everyone, his mom, his sister, and his dad all went to prison while he worked 8 to 13 hour shifts in a factory as a child. So he, for his entire life, was always an advocate of helping out children. He actually, Tiny Tiny probably comes from his experience with disabled children that he wanted to help out and reintegrate. He was always arguing for more sanitation in factories and whatnot, but he hated Thomas Malthusus. He thought his theories were ridiculous and that they just produced this really callous attitude towards the poor. And originally, Christmas Carol was going to be a pamphlet on the welfare of children. But then he decided people will feel really bad about that because they'll just realize that they've been terrible people and they'll try and deny it. So instead, I'll make it into a novel and that'll slowly convince people. That's why it's characters like Tiny Tim and whatnot, to make people feel very guilty about what they've done. And there's the two children with the ghosts. Which ghost is it? The Ignorance and Want. The two children. What ghosts are they with again?
They might not show up in this version.
The Muppets version, they probably don't show up. But the two...
the original version, they do.
Yes, there's two children that show up, Ignorance and Want. And Ignorance and Want are supposed to represent the problems of Victorian society. That there's people who need resources and there's people who actively ignore them, which is the Victorian elites.
So this is anti-Malthusian propaganda,
yes,
basically.
Yes, it comes through in the Muppets version very well.
So it doesn't quite map onto our concerns perfectly, because like libertarians are also
like
anti-
5 minutes talking about it.
Well, no, but like, because we're anti-Malthusian too, but yes, we're not anti-Malthusian, and like that doesn't lead us to the same conclusions as Dickens in a sense. I mean, like Scrooge, I mean, he's clearly the bad guy here and he's unfeeling and whatever, but like we're not inherently opposed to the concept of money lending. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a money lender, and
but he's not just a money lender. He's also just terrible. Like, he talks about at one point he's talking about some child, and he's like, "You should lend yourself to the surplus population," which is a term for people who should die off because there's too many of you.
Yeah.
So that kind of thing. He's not just that he's a money lender, but obviously Dickens did not like money lenders because but back then, if you took out a loan and didn't pay it back, you were considered like a criminal.
In jail, yeah.
Yeah.
Debtor's prison.
I can kind of see why you'd hate them so
much. Right.
But yeah. Dickens did believe in progress and that it would actually help people and that we weren't doomed to this really, it was called a Malthusian trap. He didn't think that. Yeah. That's what Christmas Carol is about. But it's also supposed to be about humanizing the poor, because a lot of time it was kind of viewed as, if you're poor, it's your own fault really, even though you're born into Victorian England with no opportunity. But that's why they have the whole scene at the end with the family having a small meager feast but like loving each other a lot. It's to humanize them and to make Victorian England feel terrible about what they've done.
One of his early fans was Karl Marx, actually. Marx wrote approvingly of A Christmas Carol, right? Mm-hmm. I can't remember exactly what he praised it for. Though there was a bit of a critique where he's like, he agrees, like he does such a great job showing how basically terrible and evil industrial capitalists are, and showing the plight of the poor working classes. But he doesn't offer a systemic like alternative, right? Like, so Dickens doesn't have it then, well, because of this, the Bob Cratchits of the world should, join together,
rise up and overthrow Scrooge with, they grab Tiny Tim's canes and attack him in his home or something like that.
Right.
So he doesn't offer this.
That was one of the sequels
I didn't watch.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Muppet Christmas Carol 2.
The Revenge of Tiny
Tim. Strike Back.
I would watch that film.
Yes, I would. So this goes to, I think, a larger question is, it also kind of, humanizes Scrooge, I mean, in a weird way by the end, where he sort of tries to redeem himself. He goes out and he gets the largest turkey hanging in the window and provides it to this family and everything like that. So do you think Dickens does he see Michael Caine's Scrooge as redeemable, or do you think he is trying to portray him as inherently bad because of his choices that he's made?
I think the whole point is that once you actually Scrooge is isolated, he never sees other people, doesn't pay attention to people, but once he's shown what is happening, he realizes the error in his ways pretty fast. And so it's all just about experiencing other people, I think.
In one night, he changes his mind.
One night, that's all it takes. Yeah. Well, a lot of people never actually looked at the underbelly of Victorian society. When Karl Marx lived in England, he actually never visited a factory. So that kind of stuff happens, that you live in your own world, you can stay there, and it's quite easy to.
So yeah, I mean, we have this critique of, we have a critique of unthinking, unfeeling, people with money, of capitalists, right? But like, they can be humanized and redeemed by the end. If you had to tweak the story to make it more classically liberal, because at the time you have classical liberals. This is 1840s. Isn't this the Corn Law agitation, where the Economist, the magazine, is founded, and like where we root a lot of transatlantic?
Thomas Malthus also supported the Corn Laws.
Yes. So, like, in a sense, we are on the side of Dickens in the classically liberal 1830s, 1840s sense, right? Mm-hmm. Like, but how would we tweak the story? If you had to change the story to make it even more classically liberal, how would you do that?
More Muppets.
More Muppets. Yeah,
that's the solution to everything.
Humans. Well, that's not true. You got to have one human, because the contrast is what makes it really good. Yeah. And when I think, just side note, Michael Caine, when he accepted this part, said, "I will play this as if I am in the Royal Shakespeare production."
Yeah. Puts a lot of effort into it.
There's never a wink or a nod to the audience that like he's doing it in a movie or in a Muppets production. He plays it straight, and I think that's why I really like it. But you got to have one human in there.
Getting back to Paul's classically liberal question, how would we change or alter this film? I mean, this film is a lot of it's about charity too, especially since I don't know if this happened in the Muppets version, but one of the versions I watched from like when I was little was when the beggars came to the door. I think this is in one of the original versions. Beggars came to the door asking for food, asking for donations, and I think they asked for like meat and drink or something like that. And Scrooge replies, "Oh, are there no prisons that are open now?" Which like is something we referred to earlier. But I think charity is a large part of this story. And Scrooge, obviously, in the beginning, before he's, you know, visited by ghosts and all that good jazz, was under the impression that it was their fault that they were begging for food, that he didn't owe them anything. Not necessarily that he thinks he owes them something at the end, but I think there's a larger story about charity here that we could make more classically liberal than its depiction.
It is in the movie because Bunsen Honeydew is the charity collector in this movie. So he comes to the door, just to clarify.
I don't know how I'd make it more classically liberal, but the charity angle can be good. Or maybe that they end up just not needing Scrooge by the end. That would ruin the story, though. But hopefully they'd find a way to work without someone who's so terrible like Scrooge.
Maybe if you insert a character. Yeah, you insert someone who is a Scrooge type. I mean, in other words, he's the mirror image. There's like Scrooge, his foil is a moneylender who is more generous, who is... Like, so you have some sort of foil there showing that, like, I mean, in a sense, he acts as his own. I mean, there's Scrooge before the visitation and Scrooge after. So you kind of already have that in a sense.
Maybe you could have Scrooge goes out of business because he has terrible business practices. Maybe that could be something.
The free market comes down on Scrooge.
Well, there was a whole thing. There was a humane factory owners that gave people houses and gave them higher wages and didn't make them work to death and tried to educate them and whatnot. And they tended to do better off than the people who wouldn't put coal on the fire.
That's actually a through line between both of these movies in a sense. So you can see... It's a Wonderful Life is when it criticizes Potter and Potterville and the, you know, Rentier class. It's actually also a criticism. And Capra was a New Dealer. A lot of his films, well, him personally versus, but his films promoted the New Deal in the 30s and 40s. And it was a critique of corporate welfare. Mm-hmm. So you had these old, you know, company towns where, you know, Milton Hershey would build a town full of apartments and a hospital and schools and company stores. And everyone in the town would live in Hershey, Pennsylvania, in the company town. Ford did the same thing.
The first time they actually talk about Potter in It's a Wonderful Life, they say, is he a king?
Yeah.
In his carriage.
So Potter is not just a rich guy. He's a rich guy who runs a company town. We call this the corporate welfare before the state welfare system is enacted during the New Deal. And but like that's a through line there is that you – in this was – once upon a time in the late 19th century, that was seen as the future of how to take care of the poor, of the indigent, et cetera, was through these kind of corporate welfare systems. People like – redeem Scrooge having, you know, less a moneylender, I suppose, more like the factory owner would have the factory and they provide education for the children and housing for the workers. It doesn't necessarily, I mean, it does, they do outperform. I think you're right. Like Ford used to be praised by progressives because he paid the highest industrial wage in the entire country. He's also deeply anti-Semitic, so you know, you win some, you lose some. But like that was once seen as like if you were a progressive, forward-thinking person, you wanted these kinds of people to provide welfare. Now it had downsides, and I think you can
read. Dominated by your company, and
you're dominated
leave.
By your company. There's no freedom in there. Yeah.
The Dickens answer to all this was he constantly was all about hygiene and education. Mm. That was normally his thing. He's always very afraid of children. Losing faith in God because of their situation being so terrible. Yeah. So you always about the education. But the hygiene makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Because apparently, and like in the book, it is just filthy. Like everything's just terrible.
Yeah, this is about the same time period where there's push for the first municipal like sewer systems and water systems. Philadelphia, famously, you're Philadelphia, Natalie, right?
Like Gilbert's.
The waterworks, you know, that was 1880s, 70s, I think. But so at this time, you have these cities that we recognize are like modern, filled with millions of people, and they're still throwing their sewer stuff into the streets. So yeah, people, it was a problem. It was a problem, hygiene.
That's the way to put it.
That's right. So what, like, we've been talking a lot about Muppets. We talk a lot about the Christmas Carol and Dickens. Like, what do you think adding Muppets in really adds to it for you, Landry?
Well, it's just adorable, first of all. Anytime you've got humans interacting with Muppets and taking it seriously, I'm just automatically more enraptured. But I don't know. I'm not sure what it is about Muppets as opposed to others. I really just like this version the best because
whenever you get the Muppets together, you're going to get big names, too. You've got all the Muppets, all their Muppeteers, and then you get Michael Caine in there. It's, I mean, the only thing that would make it better is if it was like, you know, Muppets Take Manhattan or something like that, where it's like we've got cameos the whole time coming in left and right.
You want like Justin Bieber to pop in and sing with the Muppets or something?
Take my money right here. They got Tim Curry from Muppet Treasure Island. I want to see him in a Muppet.
That's my favorite Muppet movie.
Because it's the best one.
Yeah.
Really, it was just an excuse for, you know, we wanted to talk about A Christmas Carol because it's a classic and it, I think, is a story that, you know, we can learn a lot from. I think everybody can learn from a visit from Jacob and Robert Marley, as Statler and Waldorf are, you know, known as when they visit. So I really just wanted an excuse to talk about Muppets.
And basically, I lost because I said my favorite version was Mickey's Christmas Carol, but Ooh. Yeah.
We don't have the money to talk about that.
No. Disney will come.
They will come for us.
Oh my gosh.
Please don't sue us, Jim Henson. No, we're good.
But I think we could probably expect at least two or three more editions of Christmas Carol within the next 10 years. I think the latest one came out.
They did Jim Carrey. Was that the one?
Yeah, Jim Carrey came out. What was that? Gosh, 3 or 4 years ago?
I don't know.
It's like the Grinch. They keep coming out with new versions of the Grinch, too.
Time is a flat circle. You know.
I'm going to like put on my libertarian hat for a second and be like, because this came up with It's a Wonderful Life, too. Our copyright system is too restrictive. So both of these stories, the real reason why we get so many Christmas Carol adaptations is because you can do it for free. The source material is in the public domain. That encourages creativity. I mean, like, you can imagine if the family of Dickens still controlled the rights to Christmas Carol, would they have been like, we want to take a real flyer on letting people put puppets in this hallowed piece of the literary canon? No, the odds are they would have rejected that kind of – but when you allow that into the public domain, it creates – it encourages innovation, ingenuity. It's a Wonderful Life. It underperformed the box office, dropped off the map. No one thought about it for the next 30 years. And then because the rights lapsed temporarily, the Turner Broadcasting System, which was – I mean, today everyone's like, oh, TBS, I know what that is. But back then, no one knows what TBS is. It's just struggling new nascent cable companies. Like, we're desperate for content that's free that we can play on a loop from Thanksgiving to Christmas.
Jimmy Stewart, perfect.
Jimmy Stewart, right? Like, they're vaguely famous people in here and no one's enforcing the rights because there's no profit to be had. But again, copyright law is way too strict. Now, that's a libertarian hill I'll die on, that we do need property rights. I think intellectual property is good, but it's gone too far. And part of this is because of Disney. Every time the copyright term starts to – it's about to lapse.
It gets close to when Mickey becomes public domain.
They extend it a little bit farther. And that's discouraged cultural innovation in America over the last half century or so.
Now, It's a Wonderful Muppet Life – that might be a Christmas movie.
We should contact the right people
Clarence,
for that.
Though?
How about Elmo?
It would be Elmo. Yeah. I was going to say animal, but it would be Elmo, I think.
Moving on to our very serious movie, Jingle All the Way, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger. This is a more, you know, comedy, low-key, maybe not well
highbrow known drama. That's what this is right here.
It's like
Christmas movie.
He's not a tumor.
All right.
Not this Schwarzenegger movie, but I just had to
all
say
right.
it.
At least we got one Schwarzenegger impression out here. So this is essentially just a story about how Christmas is about material things, right? We have Arnold Schwarzenegger going after Turbo Man, which is the must-have toy.
The Tickle Me Elmo or the Cabbage Patch Child of
hey,
this season.
Hey, don't knock down on Cabbage Patch.
I had a bunch
of those. Okay. So anyway, Turbo Man is like the end-all be-all to Christmas. Your kid is going to be miserable and hate you forever if you don't get it. And I think he's electronic too, right? He makes noises.
Oh,
and
yeah. Like, he's an action figure.
It doesn't look that good. That's one weird thing about the film. It doesn't actually look that. Yeah.
Well, so we're gonna turn to Paul Meany here because this is the first time he's watched this film.
Never heard of it.
He had never heard of it until a few days ago.
First impressions, Paul.
I was speechless the entire time. It went from people laughing at poor old Arnie in the shop to him fighting Santa ninjas, and there was a boomerang, there was a bomb scare.
Yes, there is a postal worker who threatens threatens a radio station with a bomb.
That wouldn't play so well in the post
9/11. No, it would not. It would not. Also, Sinbad's character originally supposed to be Joe Pesci. Little known fact.
Well, my personal favorite scene from the movie was actually when Arnold Schwarzenegger goes to steal the toy from his neighbor's house, and he almost sets the neighbor's house on fire because, like, I don't know, the Christmas tree fell into something, whatever.
It's like what's the animal that comes in? It's like a deer or something?
Oh, yeah. So he goes outside.
It's a reindeer, I think.
He goes outside and starts drinking with the reindeer. That was, I mean, there are so many just classic scenes in this movie.
Any of the scenes with Phil Hartman, because he is a gem, and he can any line read from him is great.
So I guess, I mean, I don't have children, but there's only one person at this table who does. Paul, would you do this for George?
Do what for?
Just would you go through this?
Go through this ordeal.
I would have said unequivocally no before I had a child. And then you have a child and I mean, George is obsessed with Hot Wheels. If I did not give him some Hot Wheels set for Christmas, and thankfully it's not as specific as I want Turbo Man, but I start to understand that. I still don't think I would, but I get the temptation to like, that's anything else and the kid's not going to be happy on Christmas, and you want to make your kid happy on Christmas. And of course, in Arnold's situation, there's, you know, strife at home, and he thinks that buying this thing will kind of fix everything, repair his relationship with his son, with they're still married, right?
Yeah, but he's like worried that she's cheating on him with Phil Hartman.
He's worried that Phil Hartman is going to steal his wife out, you know, from his arm. He also is, I believe, considered to be like a workaholic.
Yeah. Mattress salesman.
And so, yes, he's a mattress salesman. and so it, you know, to me, it sort of raises the question. It's a question about capitalism. Like, has it gone too far? Like, is he pushed to work too hard?
Hasn't gone far enough. They don't have enough Turbo Man.
That was going to be what I was sort of talking about. It was like, and it raises these questions about, like, there's a scarcity of Turbo Men out there.
Online ordering, that'd make it all better. Like the shops where they're just fighting each other? No way. More capitalism is the solution to the shortage of Turbo Man.
It leads to innovation. Absolutely.
That's the only thing I took from this film that was so bizarre.
Okay, that was going to be.
So I'm done now.
All right, everyone. That's our show. Thanks so much.
Tommy's put in everything he's got.
there's that bit. I mean, when Common Sense Media, which is one of those like Christian film rating websites, they gave it a low rating, 1.5 stars or something, because they said it was about consumerism. Mm. But it's actually supposed to be. I mean, it's one of those films where there's an intended purpose and then there's the way people actually watch it. The intended purpose is supposed to be a critique of mindless consumerism. Like, he shouldn't work so much. He shouldn't think that buying a thing will fix his family and his relationship with his son. Like, and he realizes that at the end, I should value my family more and work less and not be a mindless consumer. But there's the intended purpose and there's the way people actually watch it, which is like that's kind of tacked on at the end. The reason why people watch it is like, oh, look how funny it is that he's going after this doll, in which case you can kind of see it as an affirmation of consumerism in a sense. So there's that. I don't know. You want to have your consumer's cake and eat it too.
But not all these scenes are like totally unrealistic though. So like him fighting in the store for the last one, or like pushing people out of the way when the store door opens, like that kind of stuff happens all the time. Like, have you been to the King of Prussia Mall on Black Friday?
I've never
like
been
it is a do or die type situation.
I'm about to have my first Black Friday. Not a thing at home back in Ireland. So this is my first time.
Oh, this is exciting.
You're going to fight someone.
Paul to the King of Prussia.
Black Friday actually starts like on Thursday now. So
it's not even everything, all that creep. It's like elections or primaries. They just keep getting front loaded.
Yeah. I thought Black Friday is not as crazy as it used to be.
You're right.
Because of online.
Now it's Cyber Monday.
And Cyber Monday.
Which is much better.
Do you think there is a Jingle All the Way 2 starring Larry the Cable Guy? It was a straight to DVD film produced by WWE Media. And it has at least one professional wrestler in it. But I'm wondering if we get a, you know, Jingle All the Way 3. The re-jingling or something. If it'll be about Cyber Monday and like to get the perfect toy for
you know, I mean, a child, a mom has to like break into an Amazon warehouse in the middle of the night and like hijack servers and like drive around one of their little robots.
Well, also like on Cyber Monday now, people wait in virtual lines to get like on the store sites. I don't know if you guys have ever done this. It's not very fun. But like you have to open your browser and it's like you're 320th in line. And it's like it sets you to a different homepage. And then when you have access to the site, because there's so many people trying to get on at one time, they don't want it to crash, then they'll let you go on to
I'd rather do that than stand in a real line, though.
Yeah, because
I don't like the people next to me. I'm like, it's I don't like the spirit of Black Friday.
Shoving people and grabbing things sounds terrible.
It's the worst. I would much rather be bored at my house on, you know, in front of my computer with a mug of hot chalky, having a good time with my flannel on. Then, you know, be out at midnight on the day after Thanksgiving when I've just woken up from my tryptophan coma. So I think this is one of the cases where, you know, as Paul mentioned, you know, innovation has allowed for us to improve our lives.
Okay,
as pessimistic as people can be.
Though we still want more Arnold Schwarzenegger movies to keep pumping out.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Absolutely.
It is funny, like, because the Terminator Dark Fate is just now coming out with Arnold, you know, kind of recasting his Terminator
just
role.
Just came out.
Why does everyone say Arnold's name that way? Just, Arnold.
We're on first name basis.
Yeah.
Arnie.
Yeah. You mean to say governor instead, governor of California.
No.
But what's interesting about his little career and big career, I should say.
Yeah, it's not a little career, Paul.
Pumped career. And this, the role of this movie in it is that, like, so to get all like nerdy, film nerdy on you, there's this film critic called John Coelty. I got this by way of the YouTuber Nerd Writer, anybody, Nerd Writer fans out there, but who has this theory about the life cycle of genre films. And like Coelty is applying it to Westerns, and then Nerd Writer is applying it to superheroes. But I think it also applies here to action films. So those who are fans of action movies know that the 80s was the like golden age of the action film and a certain kind of action hero. It was your Arnolds, your Sylvester Stallone, Jean-Claude Van Damme, and they're all these like pumped, often steroid pumping, though they, you know, wink wink nod nod, say they wouldn't, these, you know, pumped characters who are larger than life. A lot of it, and if you're – for those you know, kind of cultural critics who have some history background, it's a reaction to the like 70s and 60s and American failures at the time. Like we lost in the Vietnam War, but you know what? We need to say it wasn't our fault. It was because of traitorous generals or lack of
pencil
will.
Pencil pushers always.
That's Rambo. Rambo is – we could have won if we'd been allowed to win, especially the later ones, the two and the other later sequels. Even Arnold, like all those movies are this brash, like we're not in the Jimmy Carter malaise anymore. This is Reagan's America. Proud, we're strong and muscular and assertive.
It's all masculinity.
We can fight, you know, and just vague, ambiguous brown people in whatever overseas situation they're set in, right? So it's kind of, yeah, it's like a late Cold War hyper masculinity on display. So what's interesting is this movie, like what are they doing with this guy who's recognized king of that genre? This is 10 years later. It's the 90s. What's he doing in this kind of ludicrous role? Well, it's parody. And so in genre film, Coelty's point is that genre films, they reach a point of saturation that people kind of become tired of them. People become tired of that classic 80s action film. It started to feel trite, had all these tropes, and it got boring. And it seemed hollow and inauthentic by the 90s. And so you start to parody it. And that's what this is. This film's a parody of the action film. Like he's fighting not to spread freedom or to win the Vietnam War or whatever. He's fighting to get a doll.
And
a
he
toy.
Dresses up as Turbo Man to do that.
Dresses up as Terminator.
And fights Santa.
Cheesy. It's over Ninja Santas.
Ninja Santas, sorry.
And so it's a kind of, it's a parody of the roles he would have played in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. Of course, then after in Coelty's cycle, eventually you get back to reaffirmation of myth. Mm-hmm. You get demythologization, which is films like, you think like No Country for Old Men, yeah. Which like, that's an action film, and it's kind of like, ooh, this is
more of like a noir than anything, yeah. I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you get to reaffirmation of myth in the superhero genre. That's like Logan and The Dark Knight are a reaffirmation of myth. It doesn't matter if it's true or not. It's kind of a nostalgia for I wish this is a world where this could be true. And we got, in a sense, we have Terminator Dark Fate as a reaffirmation of myth. We've gone long enough now that it's like we are nostalgic for a time when we all kind of bought into Arnold as this like legit action hero. And we want to unironically imagine a time where that seemed like a – not a realistic world, but that seemed like a thing that we wanted as a society. So anyways, so this movie plays the parodic role in that. And I think that's interesting.
And I think I was reading something online. It's usually Arnold Schwarzenegger's most forgotten film. I was like, well,
who did
why?
They serve that?
It's definitely his most famous.
I was like, I want to see the stats on this
all
one.
The way. Kindergarten Cop. That's it. The top two right there.
Anyway, I thought that was also funny just because, well, all that and people forget Arnold's the main character, which I was like, Arnold's like the whole movie. So I don't know how you would forget Arnold is the main character, but whatever. Some people just don't agree with us. That's fine. So I think that's all we had for today. But in true holiday spirit, Landry has written us a song.
Mm-hmm.
And he is going to perform it right now.
So you may be familiar. We had a discussion about copyright law and public domain. So I had to hunt for a song that was in the public domain. And luckily for the holidays, there are plenty. So the song is a song sung in the round. So it takes a while to get through the whole thing if you sing all the lyrics in the order as they would appear. So I'm just going to sing the very last verse of the 12 days of Libmus. On the 12th day of Libmus, the state gave to me 12 students deading, 11 whistles blowing, 10 laws regulating, 9 candidates fighting, 8 Dodds franking, 7 agencies spying, 6 schools no choosing, bureaucracy, 4 endless wars, 3 vaping bans, 2 party system, and a want for liberty. Thank you so much. Thanks for listening. If you want to hear us break down one of your favorites, Muppet-fied or not, you can follow us on Twitter at PopAndLockPod. That's Pop, the letter N, Lock, with an E, Pod. Make sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. We look forward to unraveling your favorite show or movie next time. Pop and Lock is produced by Tess Terrible and me, Landry Ayers, as a project of libertarianism.org. To learn more, visit us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.